Oregon this morning. It's a good way to get started. We have been looking at some various cores from the law the last couple days. Yesterday, we dipped into that enormous area of wrongs, public wrongs that we usually call crimes, and private wrongs that a lawyer would call torts. The difference between these two things is essentially that a public wrong, a crime, is redressed in the name of the people as a whole, the state, the people against John Smith, you see, is a typical type for criminal action, while a private wrong, a tort action, personal injury, this sort of thing, or trespass against one's right of privacy, etc., is normally redressed by a private action, which provides a damage recovery for the individual. If we had time, I would invite you to think about that for a while, to ask why we make this delineation between public and private wrongs. It has not always been so. In fact, the early roots of the law as we know it today, it didn't have a private action for damages at all. If a man lost his arm or leg or a spear finger or something of this sort because of his neighbor's negligence, the recovery ran in favor of the tribe. The tribe was redressed because it, as a unit, as a group, had been injured rather than the individual. The individual did not have a right to be compensated himself, as the loss was not his as much as it was the group with which he was identified or which he belonged. This feeling of group, of unit, has been very strong throughout the history of man, even to the place where in the Roman law, which we, especially European lawyers in the civil law, tend to look at as being a model, the father, the pater familias, was a big man. He isn't like the comic strip cartoon character that passes for a father, the head of a house today. The father in Rome was the head. He could even kill his children with impunity. This is real discipline. He didn't even need a reason particularly. His word simply went, that's all. And lest someone think that Rome in its glory was a place that was soft, don't ever forget that among other things, Rome had on the average of 50 newborn infants a night delivered on the public square to die of exposure. This is the way the society operated. A child that was either unwanted or seemed in any sense defective was simply put on the square. And if anybody happened to want a slave, or if a man who ran a brothel wanted a few new prostitutes to raise around the house, this is where they came from. Go down, help yourself to the nightly supply of newborn infants. Never overlook this when you start talking about the legal structure of a society such as Rome. Because with firmness and control comes arbitrariness. And the function of the law, among other things, is to try and equate the desirable elements of order, structure, authority, with permissiveness, freedom, individuality. And to put these things into an acceptable balance is what we are constantly struggling for. And this, of course, is what I was trying in part to illustrate yesterday in talking about what is wrong, when is conduct wrong, you're saying. Why? What standards are we going to say that conduct is wrong? And if you do decide it's wrong, what are you going to do about it? What kind of sanctions? Sanction in the law means restraints, not blessings, but restraints. Punishments, deterrence, what kind of sanctions will one apply, and finally, for what purpose or by what right? So this is that element of the law, that pocket category of the law, wrongs. But as I was trying to suggest to you Monday, if your memories are that long, indeed if you even understand what I'm muttering about, there is more here of difficulty. Monday, you may recall that I talked about carrots and sticks, the concept of moving society forward as one would a beast of burden. by one of two means, either by holding out a goal in front of the animal, try and persuade it on, lead it on by an inducement of this sort, or alternatively by belaboring the other end of the beast with a stick. Is there any truth at all for this kind of a pattern or an analogy? Can law have a guiding, an aspiring element as well as it does a restriction or a limitation? Well, now that Pastor Halverson is here, I'm not going to fish with him to start. And by picking up a couple comments that necessarily developed in this sort of an exchange. This, of course, is his myopia. When he regards law as being dull, dry, and uninteresting, one must ask, when you have an apparently intelligent person, how can this happen, you say? How can a person who is not medieval in his attitude, who does have some professed concern, at least, for the whole man, ride blissfully ignorant over the details, the things where man lives? Perhaps this is the curse of the theologian. A pie-in-the-sky attitude of it's necessary to do these things, but not today. That life is not real. It isn't lived in reality here, but rather in an abstraction. I'm not suggesting that this is Halverson. I'm suggesting that this kind of thinking, however, may be productive of a man who does not see the day-to-day necessity of having some operating forces. Now, of course, he says, I think of law as his Halverson, wrenched out of context and distorted. As by definition, no problem becomes a legal problem if there is a knowable answer. And it's the matter of how do you decide the undecidable? How do you finally decide what to do about something where you cannot know? And this is a leap of faith indeed. It's finally determining that this has enough value and merit in itself to justify going ahead and doing something with this person in order to get the ball game moving again. Now, that's something that you may do, may be a very slight thing, such as putting him in jail for a month, or it may be a rather major thing, such as taking his life. It may be a significant thing, such as telling a nation that they must move away from their native soil, because now, in the wisdom of an international court, it belongs to somebody else. You can do that sort of thing by law if you've got a man with a nightstick that's big enough to enforce what you say. This is the necessary ingredient in law, and I ask you now to focus down on this one, and that is the necessity of having the power, just the brute force, to make stick what the deciding group decides. And then I'm going to ask you to compare that with, can the law work at all by sheer persuasiveness, by psychological or emotional or moral or something else values, other than brute force? Let me put that same thing in a different way for you. I've suggested to you before that law deals only with tolerable minimums of conduct, and that this is the only appropriate function for law, is that it insists that there be a minimum amount of law, of order, of peace, of structure in a society, so that people are not constantly engaged in beating each other. And the argument now runs that this is all that law should do, that law should never try to tell me what my values are, that it ought not to tell me what to believe in my religion, that it ought not to tell me what to regard as being beautiful in art, that it ought not to tell me how to be loving to my wife or to my children, that it should do nothing about my values, but it should only preserve a tolerable minimum structure in the world, in order that in this structure I may develop my own values, and I may give voice and vent to my own feelings about my interpersonal relationships, etc., etc. This is one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that law is a far too valuable method, a machine, to waste, and that society, government, authority, ought to feed through legal channels those things which society now decides are good for people. I see a man or a woman through their plate glass window, sitting in the front room of their home, quietly drinking himself to death. He is not failing to support his family. He has adequate funds. He is not driving a car on the highway. He's too smart to drive because he's constantly intoxicated. He is not making any obscene gestures. He is not doing anything that he shouldn't do. He's sitting in his front room, quietly drinking himself to death. And I say to myself, this man needs help. As a Christian individual, I may go knock on the door and say, brother, it's hard on your liver. You shouldn't drink that much. This is going to bring you to an untimely end. As a law enforcement officer, should society send me out with the strong arm of the law to knock on his door and say, brother, we have decided, society has decided, that what you're doing is hard on you. And because it's hard on you, it reflects on our entire culture. And therefore, we're going to stop it. Or is this not the function of the law ever to say to a man whose conduct is not affecting anyone else, but this is just the way he wants to live? As long as he is affecting only himself, and the curse is a private curse, then it is a private problem to be handled through the avenues of persuasion, through the cleric, through the social worker, through the medic, through the psychiatrist, if he wants to go to them, if he doesn't, not. Shall we even go further and insulate this man from the well-meaning do-gooders who come rapping on his door and say, I've got the cure for you? And if he puts up a sign that says, no cure is desired, shall I send out an officer to see that no cure is wrong? Family. At the time of formation, the contract to marry, and I suppose I ought to define contract for you, since it becomes rather important in thinking about this. Contract is a promise or a group of promises which the law regards as being enforceable, for the breach of which the law will in some way give a remedy, such as damages or injunctive enforcement or something of this sort. Well, the contract to marry is the first step that the law sees in reference to the formation of a marriage unit, of a new package. The law impinges upon the formation. It's active at the termination or the dissolution of a marriage, whether it comes by death, desertion, divorce, or one of the other partial disintegrations that may occur to a marriage. And once in a while during the existence of a marriage, the law will impinge upon the free action of the parties who are involved in the family, especially if third parties are involved. In other words, if something that the family is doing, such as buying a new car, involves an outsider, and it's a question of the outside vendor of that automobile against the property ownership of the family, the law then regulates, because this is outside the self-contained unit of the family. And once in a long, long while, the law will step in to try and adjust a dispute even inside the family. But this is very infrequent. The attitude of the law basically is that inside the family, the people who are in that family must be given tremendous freedom to work out their own government. That is to say, if they decide that the youngest child in the family is going to be the one that calls all the shots and makes all the decisions, that's fine. Go ahead and experiment with it that way. If you want to have a system where the wife makes all the decisions, fine. That doesn't apply necessarily when you get a representative speaking for the family to the outside world. We assign a person that responsibility to be the spokesman, and that person historically is the father in the family. Although how many families do you know where the power behind the throne, as we say, the decision-making unit is really not the Father at all. He simply gets the word and carries the message to Garcia. He fronts for the operation. So inside the unit, the decisions may be made almost with impunity. And how far should this go? Take the man who beats his wife regularly. And she finally goes down to the prosecuting attorney and complains and says that I'm tired of being beaten. I've been beaten enough. Do something about it. Come out and tell my husband to quit. I'm now asking you in all sincerity, would you have the prosecuting attorney at this point call the policeman and send the policeman out to the family and say to the husband, stop beating your wife and treat her with conjugal kindness? Or will you insist that the wife, if she wants assistance from the state, the muscle, the power, the authority, the nightstick, must the wife then elect to admit that the family organization has now crumbled and that they can't handle their own affairs anymore, that they are conjugally incompetent, and she now is asking for some sort of rather drastic relief, such as put my husband in jail, or give me a divorce, or something else of this nature, which will admit, you see, that she and her husband and the children, as a self-governing unit, are incapable of self-government. It depends how strongly you feel about whether or not the law ought to insist upon tolerable minimum limits only, or whether the law ought to be in there trying to upgrade the operation of the family itself. I am convinced from my association with my colleagues from the what they call and what I will admit are the helping sciences, since I am not one of them. I don't like that. These people tell me that they can remake husbands today, and I believe that they can. I believe that a good psychiatrist or a psychologist, given a man who is non-amenable as a husband, can remake him in the general order of cream of wheat so that he's going to be perfectly bland. He'll come out a rather acceptable type of husband for anyone. Docile, tractable, housebroken, gem. I think this can be done. I think that society could go in and remake this man, but do you want it? You see, this is the problem. This is the eternal problem that comes to the law. How much intervention should there be in the life of the individual? Now, what I'm trying to do at this moment is to set the question of whether or not civil law, man's law, and we have not resolved the question of whether or not this is the same as God's law, or whether we're talking about two completely separate and different things here. If you want to make that determination, you see, then a lot of questions are going to be answered really fast for us. If you once decide whether Riki as a lawyer is working just in man's own set of values over here that has nothing to do with eternal verities. Go back to Monday, think about Thomas Aquinas, Hans Kelsen, and the American proposition. That is, it is natural law written in the clouds by God. Aquinas, it is just logic and utility. What works with this group of people, that's what the law ought to be, including Hitler and liquidating the Jews, Kelsen. The American proposition, relative blur, yes, is the answer to any question you want to ask. Is it divine? Yes. Is it logical? Yes. Is it tested by eternal verities? Yes. You know, inalienable rights in the Constitution, what a bunch of blithering nonsense this is. What is an inalienable right? Unless it's created by God. And at the same time, we say that our government is one which is based upon utility and the needs of the people to be adjusted this way by experience rather than by the wave the flag and pound the Bible sort of illustration which is set out in our Bill of Rights. So you've got to make that sort of a determination. Well, one path takes you down to the place where you say, all right, this is just man's law, and therefore it is perfectly acceptable to have it deal only with minimums, only with restrictions, only with limitations, and only to draw lines and say that you've got to stay inside of these rules. And when you have these rules obeyed, then inside you can do anything that you like. Because we're not going to try and decide for you what's valuable. That's acceptable. This is not acceptable in terms of Christianity. Because Christianity, as the other possible alternative way of looking at this thing, not only tells you what you may not do, and I think that Christianity is essentially not a matter of don'ts. Of course, we talk about it in our church connections as being law and gospel, and the law there becomes sort of the don'ts, and the gospel becomes the carrot out in front. The do's, the lift, the goal, the aspirations, the values. Law is valueless. Law doesn't tell you where you want to go. Back in the corridors of Condon Hall, it's the law school where I associate with other weird persons, we argue vehemently about this because, you see, I associate with many people who believe that day by day in every way we're making ourselves better, who honestly are convinced intellectually that man has the capacity to structure himself into a happier and fuller and richer world, who believe that if we are just intelligent enough and use our heads enough and use our vehicles, such as law, enough, that we will be able to build here little by little an ever better and higher and richer plateau to which man can move himself. And the other side of this argument, and you go where you think logic takes you at this point. Ricky on the other side of this one says it's perfectly sterile in this sense. Law doesn't have a seed at all. There's no semen in this process whatsoever. It simply maintains a seed bed. Someone else has to plant. Someone else has to give rise to the growth of good here, because there is no good in law. There is only order, which is desirable, it's necessary. It's necessary only because of man's sinfulness, you see. The day that we all become good, I'm out of business. I'm not worried about unemployment, because I think this is the very nature of man, to live under this curse. And I think as long as it's there, the law must be the adjuster. The question of authority is, of course, important. The theologian sees authority here as being God. The lawyer sees authority as being what? Well, I suggested to you a few moments ago, just brute power. The ability to enforce the decision which is made. If you've never thought of it before, think of it now and get a slight chill. We believe that we have constitutional protections. But what does the Constitution mean? The Constitution means, I think I'm disclosing no secrets, it means what the United States Supreme Court says it means. The very methodology that we use in constructing the phrases of the federal Constitution assumes that it's written every morning fresh, that it's an uninterpreted doctrine, really, essentially, every morning. I'm overstating my point, but nonetheless, I want you to see the sweep of this thing. With a statute that the legislature enacts and may reenact at the next session of the legislature, a court decides what certain words means, and that history of interpretation becomes rather restrictive of the court's interpretation. It builds and interprets, and then it regards itself as being essentially bound by its own interpretation. But constitutional language is not meant to be restrictive. It's meant to be enabling. And so when the court comes to the Constitution, it doesn't matter what they said last year about the constitutional point. This morning it's a new document, and they get to interpret it all over again in light of today's needs. Think of free but equal. I mean separate but equal facilities. It's the best illustration in modern times. The court for generations, really, interpreted separate but equal facilities.
as being constitutional, and here in the last couple of years, we've seen a complete reversal of this. All right, so then this protection that we have in the Constitution depends upon the interpretation which is given to it by the Supreme Court. But how does the Supreme Court enforce its decisions? Well, the Supreme Court depends, of course, upon the public's acceptance or upon strength. And if you were outside, in the outside world today, reading the newspapers, you would get an idea, a classic illustration of what's going on in the world right now, in Rochester, New York, other parts of the world, where society is not accepting what the court has decreed. And now what happens? Where people en masse resist, and where civil obedience disintegrates, and where hatred and animosity displaces love. This is now the function where law has got to operate, you see, with a whip. If we as a Christian group are unable to persuade and to convince by the values, by the carrots which we have to offer, if we cannot grab man's mind by the love of God, then society, in order to perpetuate itself, must resort to the unpleasant alternative of the whip. But are we capable of this sort of self-flagellation? Can we really whip ourselves into obedience? Perhaps we are about to see another low spot in the history of the United States where we play this game. Certainly the shallowest point in our history came with Lincoln. I think this is seldom recognized, but you've got to see this thing in context to appreciate what it's all about. Lincoln, we sometimes think of non-lawyer, sometimes think of Lincoln as being the great lawyer. He was a lawyer. And yet it was also Lincoln who imprisoned a colonel in the army, and illegally so. And the court, the lower court, and finally the Supreme Court of the United States issued a writ of habeas corpus. This man is being unlawfully held. Release him. And Lincoln said, "I will not." And the court said, "You must. Constitutionally, this man may not be imprisoned. Let him out." This is the United States Supreme Court, the Constitution, mother, the flag, any context you want to put it. And Lincoln says, "I won't." And the court says, "You will." And Lincoln said, "Whose army are you going to use? Are the nine of you going to storm the fortress, you see, and take him?" This is the place where truth is out. In the last analysis, brute force. Might make right, or does right make might, you see? In the last analysis, if you don't have the power to implement the decree of the court, then you have the dictatorship. Lincoln, the great dictator. We dipped briefly into this sort of a period again with FDR, quite unsuccessfully this time. Perhaps we'll see a little bit of this again before we get through. Now, how does all of this apply to the family? Well, it's easy to show, because in the family, you see it in a microcosm. You see it in a form that we can all witness, the way in which it works. Somebody in the family has muscle, either intellectual or physical, and gets to make his decisions stick. Now, how do you identify the person who's going to have this sort of authority? Well, at the outset, at the beginning, in the beginning, at the point of creation of this unit, the law gives a general push and says, this is the way that we usually structure them. Now, along with this comes all of the sociological stuff that goes into building the way in which people function. And here, again, if we had time to explore, you can do all of those beautiful things. Like what happens when an American woman marries a Mexican man, and what happens when an American man marries a Mexican woman. Entirely different, just totally different results. When an American man marries a Mexican woman, life is love and roses. He expects to be God Almighty or close to it, and she expects to be kicked around like a mule. These expectations are helpful to both partners. The man is in a bed of roses, and the woman doesn't know that life is ever any better. Things go along beautifully. Their expectations are not only met, but they are that the cup runs over in the roles that they anticipate playing. But when an American woman marries a Mexican man, oh, ho, 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 she thinks that she is an individual. Stupid thought, says he. He thinks that he is the only person whose word ought to have any weight. Intolerable, says she. And so one can take this sort of mixed marriage. All right, if you don't want to mix Americans and Mexicans, mix people from the United States and Europe, or Europe and Asia, or Roman Catholics and Lutherans, or any other mixture that you want, the young and the old, diverse cultures, this is what I'm getting at, and let their expectations be frustrated. And then watch the breakdown, you see. So immediately you can start to project out into the formation of a political unit, a social unit, whether it's the state of Washington or the United States or the United Nations, certain things which must exist in order to have the control which you are trying to project survive at all. You must have an exercise of authority which is going to be tolerable to the governed. We the people, you see, or we the family. And these sort of expectations are built, in fact, by the persons who are involved, and also by what the culture has taught them that they ought to expect about these things. Now, some of the broad ground rules for the operation of any unit, again, whether it's a nation or whether it's a family, are laid out in advance by the other units that operate in the world. This is the place where this unit comes into conflict with this one. And this doesn't operate solely in its own sphere. So some of our rules for marriage are given to us in advance by our general structure of society. Here is a place at the formation where it is permissible for the law to require certain things before we will permit this new productive unit to come into operation. We will license just as cold-bloodedly, I would like to think, but I know it's not so. Just as logically, I would like to think, but I know it's not so. We will license the applicants for marriage just as we would license the man who wants to operate a new boat company up and down Lake Chelan. Is it needed? Does society desire this? Is this a sound operation? Are the probabilities of success great enough to justify issuing the license and letting this business get started? Or is this one that we ought to nip in the bud? Now, the question is not whether or not society ought to decide who is going to marry whom. We're in that business. Martin Luther put us there. The question is, upon what standards will you do so? Sometimes it seems to me we either ought to get out of the licensing business entirely or else do it wisely. The basis upon which a marriage license will be denied today consanguinity. If you want to marry your sister, your mother, we say no. Is this because of biological data in the background? Is it true that inbreeding here produces an inferior product? You find lots of lovely court opinions which will point out that the first cousins here who purported to get married, not really married at all, because first cousins ought not to marry. And if any further proof of this is needed, observe the fact that the only child born to them is born deaf and dumb and blind or something else, you see. Now, this is, I think, a biological accident. You all know more about breeding than that. Or shall we say that there are other values, which we're trying to implement through our licensing laws? Here, I invite you to watch your step more carefully than you do coming down the steepest part of the trail out of Lake Holden. One false step here, my friends, and you have me as a lawyer and all my colleagues actively implementing the religious values of society. Do you want me to limit the issuance of licenses on strictly scientific data? Or do you want to try and implement some other values by this way? let me give you an illustration, for example. You all know about population in the world today, all those lovely things that we talk about. If one graph, as far as we know, the population of the world, starting back with a few people back here, the graph would go something like this. As late as the turn of the century, we had very, very few people in the world. But this projection here is just unbelievable, just unbelievable. Another 50, 60 years becomes almost intolerable, mathematically projected. Now, what do you want me as a lawyer to do about this? Shall I say, no more marriages? We got more than we can use already? Or shall we say, yes, you may be married. We're happy to have you enjoy the association that marriage gives to a married couple, but no children, please. Or shall I say, and I think this is going to be within the realm of scientific possibility very shortly, and parenthetically I might say that if I live a normal lifespan, I expect to see this date, that when my wife and I wish to have a child, we will go down to the city hall and put in our application and say we would like to produce a child. What openings are there? And the auditor will flip through the book and say, well, we can schedule you for one boy on the 14th of June or thereabouts. And delivery date is optional within a short period either way. And this is all we can use. We don't have any other openings at the moment. Back later. Shall we handle our population problem this way? And shall we, in the process of doing so, say, I'm sorry, but we don't need any more persons of Norwegian background? Right now, somebody else. We can do this. We can do this. Now, once more, let me repeat what I said a moment ago, lest you miss the point. The question is not whether or not we should get into this business. We're there. We are already saying, no, I'm sorry, you may not marry each other because you do not have the genetic qualities that we think that we desire. Now, it's in a very gross measure that we're doing it today. It's only certain things, some of which are scientifically laughable, where we draw our lines today. These are our inheritance from the Dark Ages. For example, what possible sense does it make to say to a person, no, you may not marry your sister-in-law after the death of your wife, because our religion teaches us that when a man and a woman marry, they are one, and therefore when you married your wife's sister was your sister, and you may not marry your sister. That's the law in a good many places in the world today. It's called the doctrine of affinity. And you see where it came from? Well, of course you see where it came from. It came from the idea of oneness. Probably a theological distortion. Not mine, sir. Jump on the law abstractly. My point here is that in the licensing process, we are already determining who is going to marry whom, under what circumstances. The question is, what ought the standards to be? And as long as you get irresponsible people, like Halverson, running around saying, I won't get into this because my problems deal with something greater and finer, then, of course, you will never be able to help me resolve this problem. You liked that one? Let me give you another one, which is in the same order. Whether you know it or not, artificial insemination has been a reality for many, many years, centuries. Not with human beings. It started with fish and camels. Well, now it's becoming quite common with human beings also. I have no idea how many children are born as a result of artificial insemination, because statistics are not kept. More is the pity. How do you know whether you're going to marry your own half-sister? I do know that the problem is here. And inevitably, it must be faced, not in terms of the conception of these children necessarily, but ultimately in terms of the other problems that arise, such as a husband who one day tires of the entire operation and says, I am now going to divorce my wife and leave her and deny any support for her or for the child. And my grounds is adultery. She has borne a child after marriage, which is not my child biologically. This is true. And the child is not mine biologically. This is true. And he's got some good fat blood tests to show it, you see. There can't be any question. And therefore, I have no obligations to them. Now, number one, is this adultery? Or don't you even care whether it's adultery or not? Number two, on the hands and feet sort of question, should the husband be required to support the child which is not his? Would you, for example, make a distinction on the basis of whether or not he consented to the operation which gave rise to the conception? Some states permit this sort of consent to be given. Some do not. The great, great bulk of the world today is pulling a Halverson on us and saying, well, this is not the kind of a problem that I'd like to get into. It's very dull and dirty and unpleasant, and I'd rather not face that at all. Let's talk about something which is lovely. Whatever is that life is not lovely, especially not as the lawyer sees it in the family. Because the lawyer, unfortunately, is the guy who's like a buzzard who goes around cleaning up all the messes. When the normal operation breaks down, when people can no longer resolve their own problems in their own way, when the family starts coming unglued, when the ethical or religious or the moral values have simply gone out the window, and people are now unable to adjust, then comes the point when the law, in its magnificent simplicity, must apply its bat to preserve a modicum of order and structure in society. How do you want me to handle that problem? What should the church say to me now? I'm asking you seriously. The problem is here. The children born as a result of artificial insemination are, generally speaking, like other children. There are a few more defective births in this type of child than others, but not many more. It's tolerable. It's tolerable on a purely biological basis. But it's got an awful lot of social problems that are involved in terms of support and legitimacy, adoption problems, marriage problems. Should there at least be a disclosure of paternity on birth records so that you really will know who you are? Identification is important, you know. When you remember that donors of semen, for example, are rather few in number. It's expensive for a medical firm to work up the medical history that's necessary to determine whether or not a man ought to be a donor. That is, what is his own lineage and his genetic qualities. As a result, there are not very many cases. There are not very many donors, and they're used rather indiscriminately. There are no controls. And so in a given part of a given city where people of like religious beliefs, and obviously there is a tremendous amount of selection that goes in automatically to this sort of a problem, and like social standing, it's a sort of thing that not everyone would do, they start having children by artificial insemination, the odds are rather good that several children who are going to be going to school together will be half-bloods. And they'll never know it, of course. And the odds are rather good that when you get people of like background, socially and religiously and so forth, the odds are rather good that this young man and this young woman may develop an interest in each other. And this is not at all impossible that with our tendency toward marriage in high school today, that there are a number of half-bloods who will be marrying each other. Is it bad? I don't know if it's bad. Ask a biologist. Don't ask me. I'm just a stupid lawyer. All that I'm asking at this point is, will you people who have the knowledge and the information about what is good and what is bad here, tell me so that I can go to the legislature in the state of Washington and have them express the vehicle which will most adequately carry those things that we can agree upon as being our values. I would like to be like Halverson. I would like to say that the decisions about values are not mine, so don't leave them to me by default. Because when society defaults generally The unit which must make the decision ultimately must then fill not only the systematic operation, the means by which the decision is made, but it must also make the value decision. And those value decisions which the law is making, whether it's the law of the nation or the law of the family, those value decisions are usually ones to which the law has come because there is a vote. It must be made, and it may be made deliberately, that is to set out, do a little study in the background, and then make the rule, or more likely it's made inadvertently, and that's the next thing I'd like to try and identify for you by, again, using the family as my model. The United States, England, India, Australia, a few other nations in the world have what is generally known as the common law. It's a law which develops from decisions, where a decision of a court becomes in itself authority. Most of the rest of the civilized world, by civilized I mean nations which have been organized, the non-emerging nations at the moment, which have legal structures, are what are called civil law countries. Civil law or code law countries. The code law is one where you've set out the code in advance and then interpolate or extract from it your principles. Common law is basically one where it grows from decisions. Now, let's illustrate this decisional law thing because it is significant to an understanding of what goes on. Let's take the young man and woman who marry each other, and the first day after the honeymoon, when they're home, and now this is going to be their normal course of living. This unit of society, this young nation which has just come into existence, this state of Jane and Vern Rieke, which is a self-governing unit internally, with its own legislative powers and so forth, is free to organize itself as it will. For example, it's entirely possible, perhaps, that the wife can remain in bed and sleep until noon while the husband goes out and labors. Now, this is a possibility. It's also possible that the wife will get up early in the morning and prepare breakfast. It's possible, I suppose. Have it ready when the husband gets up and see him off to work. Are there any number of variations? Let's take a very, very simple one as our illustration here. Let's assume that they're both up and operating by the time that it's necessary for the man to go to work. The question before the legislature is whether or not a man ought to kiss his wife when he leaves the house to go to work. There's no precedent here. There is no binding authority. You can do this any way you like. You know, our culture does not say that a man has to kiss his wife as he leaves the house in the morning to go to work. There isn't any right. There isn't any great expectation already. And there isn't anything in Scripture that I've ever found that says a man has to kiss his wife as he leaves the house for breakfast. And there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States. There isn't any law on this subject. So on the first morning, when they're back in a normal operating stance, breakfast is over, he's got his hat and coat, he's ready to go, and she stands at the door. It is still possible that he could go by. And she wouldn't feel offended. Say goodbye to each other and be on his way. If he stops and kisses his wife goodbye on this occasion, and if it's a pleasant experience, and if it's repeated again the next morning and it's convenient, it soon becomes a habit, and inside of a week, a month, or 6 months, as the case may be. Now let's take the morning in which the husband is distracted. And see, this has gone on for 6 months now. He's kissed her goodbye every morning at the door. She's standing at the door like this. He is distracted, zooms by. You know what happens. My rights have been violated. There's a Supreme Court case in the making. What's wrong? He doesn't love me anymore. None of this would have been true if it had not been for the long series of precedents that had been built up. It would have been possible to have reversed this process without any great legislative activity had he kissed her the first morning and not the second morning, because then at the most a pattern of sporadic activity would have developed. This is the common law in the making, if you please. There are many, many issues to which our overall values do not speak with precision. We have these great constitutional or great religious overarching principles, which give us ideas which need to be brought down to specific applications. There's a stone tablet that was unearthed in Greece once, and it tells the story of a man who alleged that two of his goats were stolen, goats, G-O-A-T-S, were stolen by somebody else, and he hired counsel to represent him. And the stone tablet gives us a statement which is made apparently halfway through the trial by the client to his counsel. And he says to his attorney, "You have spoken most learnedly of our wars with Athens and with other Greek cities. And is it not now time to mention my goats?" It is the privilege of theologians to arch the skies with their constructs and to belabor the lawyer who must work with goats, with the details. How does one bring down from here to here into working with bite a principle that will decide the specific problem? Life is made of these little decisions. Many of them go by habits. But those that do not have a habit pattern or where it is not already organized must be organized, and as I say, the family is a beautiful place to see this in operation, because here these decisions are built very quickly. The same thing is true in a nation or in the United Nations. Summit conferences came from where? Summit conferences didn't exist before the Second World War. There was no such thing as a summit conference. As a matter of fact, it probably would have been regarded as being immoral for the heads of government to run and talk these problems over all the time. This was done through the staff of ambassadors. And Riki, now, I'm persuaded it still should be. But be that as it may, out of a practice which started innocently enough, when our man and their man and the other man started meeting in various places and under the pressures of a unique situation of a war started talking to each other, pretty soon developed a rule, a right, which says that when one nation is in trouble, it's got a right to have its head talk to another one. Let Johnson today try and refuse to talk to Khrushchev, and it's a personal affront. Why? It wouldn't have been 20 years ago. It would have been an affront to have Johnson suggest to Khrushchev that he should have talked to him. This is the development of law. It's the development of expectations, you see, out of some place. Now, where do these expectations get their roots? They ought to get them right here. They ought to get them from our religious convictions. The church ought to be speaking to us, and you understand that I'm not saying it doesn't. Suggest no such thing. The contrary, I think it does. I think that the church is really quite articulate here, and I don't mean this as coarsely as it may sound. I'm saying ought now in the sense of it's right and it's good and it's proper, that the values ought to be pumped in so that people then can try and express these values in their law also, but not as religious principles, because this is not good. This is my position as a lawyer, that what I'm doing is not good. It's necessary. It's desirable. It's an amputation that must be had. But it is not valuable in the sense that a religious principle is valuable. Rather, it is a mechanism that must be used. It's the stick. I do not see any carrots in law. I think that it's an entirely essential, very important thing. I don't think that man can live without it. But I think that it is valueless in terms of rights and wrongs. And you are perfectly entitled to belabor me vigorously on that statement. But I'm convinced that this is so. Now let me go back to the place where I came in. What man puts together, man can take asunder. In terms of law, a marriage is nothing in the world but a way of how will the title to the house be held. Who will decide how much money should be spent from the salary? It's a way of determining who is entitled to get Social Security. It's a way of determining what insurance premiums benefits will be paid to whom, how you're going to divide your tax burden. It's a way of deciding 1,001 details of citizenship, of property, of personal rights in reference to each other, even those things which we call the rights of consortium, exclusive intercourse, and so forth, are only details of the entire marriage package. It is just like the title to real property. And that's probably the most meaningless statement that I'll get off this week, since you haven't the faintest concept what the title to real property is. There is a stick which says that you have the right to go out and cut trees off of real estate. There is another stick which says that you have the right to take the minerals out of the ground. There is another stick which says that you have the right to run telephone wires above it. There is another stick which says that you have the right to use the water that comes from the stream. There is another stick which says that you have the right to erect signs and billboards and so forth. There is another stick which says that you have the right to extract oxygen from the air. And more and more and more and more. Until you get to every conceivable thing that a person can do in, on, around, under, and above a hunk of earth. If you tie all of those things into one bundle, you have a fee simple title to real estate. This is the greatest amount of ownership that a person can possibly have, even a right to determine who will have that property after I die. This is the most complete ownership and title that a person can have. You can untie that bundle, and you can give a man just this one there, which deals with the right to cut timber, and that's all that he has, you see. And you can arrange in almost any fashion you like. Take off the ropes and lay out the sticks. Here, you have the mineral rights, you have the water rights, you have the right to travel over it, you have the right to dig tunnels under it. Here's some more sticks, everybody grab one. And now we have broken up the ownership of this real property into all of its various aspects, see? Now, some lawyer someday will make a mint by gathering them all together and tying them up again so he's got another package. It has to take all sorts of interesting transactions to do this. Marriage is the same thing. Hold property as marital property. Citizenship being the same. Exclusive intercourse. The right to be supported under certain circumstances or alimony under others. And so down through a long list of things which taken together represent marriage. Now it is possible to take the ropes off of the bundle of rights which we regard as being marriage and to separate them out. I marry thee, John, for thy property. I marry thee, Henry, for the purpose of getting a name to my illegitimate child. And I marry thee, somebody else, for some other stick here. We do not yet commonly see partial marriages formed at the marriage ceremony level. But we have many instances of partial dissolutions. Almost every dissolution of a marriage is a partial one. Think, for example, of a divorce, which comes along and says, hereafter you people cannot live together in the same house. You may not legally have intercourse with each other. You're not entitled to split your income tax returns. And in case of certain other behavior patterns, this will be enjoined and so forth. But in reference to the obligation to support for alimony, and in reference to the necessity of leaving property to the children, and in reference to certain citizenship benefits which have been acquired and so forth, these things are left intact. Now, all that you've done is taken the marriage which existed and partially exhausted